practiced hand, he drew out the buildings he'd seen in his momentary whatever it had been. I've seen this pattern before, from above. That's Thalen City, Shallan said. Isn't it? That's right, Kaladin thought. He'd only visited once, opening the city's oath gate. I saw this in the vision I explained to you. He glanced at Azure, who seemed skeptical. Kaladin could still feel his emotion from the vision, that thrumming sense of anxiety, the sure knowledge that Dalinar was in grave danger. Nine Shadows, a champion who would lead the enemy forces. The Oath Gate in Thalen City is open and working, Kaladin said. Shallan and I saw to that, and since the Oath Gate in Kolinar brought us to Shadesmar, theoretically another, one that isn't corrupted by the Unmade, could get us back. Assuming I can figure out how to work it on this side, Shallan said. That's a pretty daunting assumption. We should try to reach the perpendicularity in the peaks, Azure said. It's the only sure way back. The lighthouse keeper says he thinks something strange is happening there, Shallan said. Ships from that direction have never ended up arriving. Kaladin rested his fingers on the sketch he'd done. He needed to get to Thalen City. It didn't matter how. The darkness inside him seemed to retreat. He had a purpose, a goal, something to focus on other than the people he'd lost in Kolinar. Protect Dalinar. Kaladin returned to eating his fish, and the group settled in to wait for the ship. It took a few hours, during which the clouds steadily faded in color before growing plain white again. On the other side, the high storm had completed its passing. Eventually, Kaladin saw something out on the horizon, beyond where Syl sat on the rocks. Yes, that was a ship, sailing in from the west. Except, it didn't have a sail. Had he even felt wind in Shadesmar? He didn't think so. The ship crashed through the ocean of beads, surging toward the lighthouse. It employed no sail, no mast, and no oars. Instead, it was pulled from the front by an elaborate rigging attached to a group of incredible spren. Long and sinuous, they had triangular heads and floated on multiple sets of rippling wings. Storms! They pulled the ship like chulls. Flying, majestic chulls with undulating bodies. He'd never seen anything like it. Adolin grunted from where he stood by the window. Well, at least we'll be traveling in style. 98. Loopholes. Lore suggested leaving a city if the spren there start acting strangely. Curiously, Ja'anat was often regarded as an individual, when others, like Moalak or Ashurtmarn, were seen as forces. From Hesse's Mythica, page 90. Zeth Oshinovar left the Skybreaker Fortress with the 20 other squires. The sun approached the clouded horizon to the west, gilding the Pure Lake red and gold. Those calm waters, strangely, now sprouted dozens of long wooden poles. Of various heights, ranging from 5 to 30 feet, these poles appeared to have been jammed into fissures in the lake bottom. Each had an odd knobby shape at the top. "This is a test of martial competence," Master Warren said. The Azish man looked strange in the garb of a Marabetian lawkeeper, chest bare and shoulders draped with the short, patterned cloak. The Azish were normally so proper, overly encumbered with robes and hats. "We must train to fight, if the desolation truly has begun." Without Nin's guidance to confirm, they spoke of the desolation in ifs and mights. "Each pole is topped with a group of bags bearing powders of a different color," Warren continued. "Fight by throwing those. You cannot use other weapons. And you cannot leave the contest area marked by the poles. I will call time over when the sun sets. We will tally the number of times each squire's uniform was marked by one of the bags of powder. You lose 4 points for each different color on your uniform, and an additional point for each repeated hit from a color. The winner is the one who has lost the fewest points. Begin." Zeth drew in Stormlight and lashed himself into the air with the others. Though he didn't care if he won arbitrary tests of competence, the chance to dance the lashings, for once without needing to cause death and destruction, called to him. This would be like those days in his youth, spent training with the Honor Blades. He soared upward about 30 feet, then used a half-lashing to hover. Yes, the tops of the poles each bore a collection of small pouches tied on by strings. He lashed himself past one, snatching a pouch, which let out a puff of pink dust as it came off in his hand. He now saw why the squires had been told to wear a white shirt and trousers today. "Excellent," Zeth said, as the other squires scattered, grabbing pouches.
"What?"
the sword asked. Zeth carried it on his back, tied securely in place at an angle from which he could not draw the weapon.
"I don't understand. Where is the evil?"
"No evil today, Sword Nimi. Just a challenge."
He hurled the pouch at one of the other squires, hitting her square in the shoulder, and the resulting dust colored her shirt in that spot. Notably, the master had said that only color on the uniform would be counted, so holding the pouches and dusting one's own fingers was fine. Similarly, hitting each other in the face gained no advantage. The others took quickly to the game. Soon pouches were being flung in all directions. Each pole bore only a single color, encouraging competitors to move about to hit others with as many colors as possible. Jorrit tried hovering in one spot anyway, dominating one pole to prevent others from hitting him with its color. Sitting still made him a target, however, and his uniform was quickly covered in spots. Zeth dove, then pulled himself up with an expert lashing so that he swooped, skimming the surface of the Pure Lake. He grabbed a pole as he passed, bending it out of Callie's reach as she went by above.
"I'm down too low," Zeth realized as bags of dust fell toward him. "Too easy a target."
He twisted back and forth, executing a complex maneuver that manipulated both lashings and the wind of his passing. Pouches smacked the water near him. He pulled upward. Lashing wasn't like the flight of a swallow. Instead, it was like tying oneself to strings, a puppet to be yanked about. It was easy to lose control, as evidenced by the awkward motions of the newer squires. As Zeth gained height, Zedzil fell in behind him, holding a pouch in each hand. Zeth added a second lashing, upward, then a third. His stormlight lasted so much longer than it had before. He could only assume that radiants were more efficient than those who used honor blades for the powers. He shot upward like an arrow, Windspren joining and twisting around him. Zedzil followed, but when he tried to throw a pouch at Zeth, the wind was too great. The pouch fell backward immediately, striking Zedzil on his own shoulder. Zeth dropped into a dive, and Zedzil followed until Zeth snatched a green bag from a pole and tossed it over his shoulder, hitting Zedzil again. The younger man cursed, then shot away to find easier prey. Still, this combat proved to be a surprising challenge. Zeth had rarely fought in the air itself, and this contest felt similar to when he'd battled the Windrunner in the skies. He twisted among the poles, dodging pouches, even snatching one from the air before it hit him, and found he was enjoying himself. The screams from the shadows seemed dim, less pressing. He wove between thrown pouches, dancing above a lake painted by the hues of a setting sun, and smiled. Then immediately felt guilty. He had left tears, blood, and terror in his wake like a personal seal. He had destroyed monarchies, families, innocent and guilty alike. He could not be happy. He was only a tool of retribution, not redemption, for he dared not believe in such. If he was to be forced to keep living, it should not be a life that anyone would ever envy.
"You think like Vasher," the sword said in his head. "Do you know Vasher? He teaches swords to people now, which is funny because Varatrelides always says Vasher isn't any good with the sword."
Zeth rededicated himself to the fight, not for joy, but for practicality. Unfortunately, his momentary distraction earned him his first hit. A dark blue pouch struck, its circle stark on his white shirt. He growled, soaring upward with a pouch in each hand. He flung them with precision, hitting one squire in the back, then another in the leg. Nearby, four of the older squires flew in formation. They would chase an isolated squire, swarming him or her with a flurry of eight pouches, often scoring six or seven hits, while rarely getting hit themselves. As Zeth zoomed past, they fixated on him, perhaps because his uniform was nearly pristine. He immediately lashed himself upward, canceling his lateral lashing, to try to get above the pack. These were well practiced with their powers, however, and not so easily put off. If he continued straight upward, they'd merely chase him until he ran out of stormlight. Already his reserves were low, as each squire had only been given enough to last through the contest. If he double or triple lashed himself too often, he'd run out early. The sun was slipping inch by inch out of sight. Not much time left. He simply needed to last. Zeth dove to the side, moving quickly and erratically. Only one of the pack chasing him chanced a throw. The others knew to wait for a better shot. Zeth's swoop took him straight toward a pole, but it held no pouches. Fari looked like he had gathered them all up to hoard the color, so Zeth grabbed the pole itself. He pushed it to the side, bending it until it snapped, leaving him with a pole some 10 feet long. He lightened it with a partial lashing upward, then tucked it under his arm. A quick glance over the shoulder showed that the four teammates were still tailing him. The one who had thrown earlier had grabbed two new pouches and was catching up to the others with a double lashing.
"Make a stand," the sword suggested. "You can take them."
For once, Zeth agreed. He zoomed down until he was near the water, his passing causing a trail of ripples on the surface. Younger squires dodged out of his way, flinging dust bags but missing because of his speed. He deliberately lashed himself to the side in a smooth, predictable turn. It was exactly the opportunity the pack had been waiting for, and they started throwing at him. But he was no frightened child to be intimidated and overwhelmed by superior numbers. He was the assassin in white, and this was but a game. Zeth spun and began batting the pouches away with his staff. He even managed to hit the last one back into the face of the leader of the group, a man named Ty. It wouldn't count as a mark, but the dust got in Ty's eyes, causing him to blink and slow. The group expended most of their pouches, which let Zeth, lashed now directly toward them, get close. And nobody should ever let him get too close. He dropped his staff and grabbed a squire by her shirt, using her as a shield from an opportunist outside the group who was throwing crimson bags. Zeth spun with her, then kicked her toward a companion. They slammed together, trailing streaks of red dust. He grabbed another squire from the pack, trying to lash him away. The man's body resisted the lashing, however. People bearing stormlight were more difficult to lash, something Zeth was only now coming to understand. He could, however, lash himself backward, hauling the man with him. When he let go, the squire had trouble adjusting to the change in momentum and jolted in the air, letting himself get hit by a half dozen bags from outsiders. Zeth zipped away, running dangerously low on stormlight. Only another few minutes. Beneath him, Ty called to the others, pointing up at Zeth, the obvious current winner. Only one strategy made sense at this point.
"Get him!" Ty shouted.
"Oh, good,"
the sword said. Zeth lashed himself downward, which proved wise as many of the squires shot up past him, assuming he'd try to stay high. No, his best defense while outnumbered was confusion. He got among them, a storm of pouches targeting him. Zeth did what he could to avoid them, zipping one way then the other, but there were too many attacks. The poorly aimed ones were the most dangerous, as moving out of the way of a well-placed attack almost always took him into the path of an errant one. One pouch struck his back, followed by a second. A third hit his side. Dust flew all around as the squires hit each other, too. That was his hope, that even as he took hits, they would take more. He soared up, then dove again, causing the others to dodge like sparrows before a hawk. He flew along the water, scattering fish in the waning light, then shot upward to... His stormlight ran out. His glow vanished. The tempest within died. Before the sun could set, the cold took him. Zeth arced in the air and was pummeled with a dozen different pouches. He dropped through the cloud of multicolored dust, leaving an afterimage from his loosely fastened spirit. He splashed into the Pure Lake. Fortunately, he hadn't been too high, so the landing was only mildly painful. He hit the bottom of the shallow lake. Then, when he stood up, the others hit him with another round of pouches. No mercy from this group. The last sliver of sun vanished, and Master Warren shouted an end to the test. The others streaked away, their stormlight conspicuous in the dimming light. Zeth stood waist-deep in water.
"Wow," the sword said. "I kind of feel bad for you."
"Thank you, Sword Nimi. I..." What were those two spren floating nearby, shaped as small slits in the air? They separated the sky like wounds in skin, exposing a black field full of stars. When they moved, the substance of reality bent around them. Zeth bowed his head. He no longer ascribed to Spren any particular religious significance, but he could still be in awe of these. He might have lost this contest, but he seemed to have impressed the High Spren. Or had he lost? What exactly had the rules been? Thoughtful, he ducked under the water, swimming in the shallow lake back towards the bank. He climbed out, water streaming from his clothing as he walked up to the others. The masters had brought out bright sphere lanterns along with food and refreshment. A Tashiki squire was recording the points while two masters adjudicated what counted as a hit and what did not. Zeth suddenly felt frustrated by their games. Nin had promised him the opportunity to cleanse Shinovar. What time was there for games? The moment had come for him to ascend to a rank beyond all of this. He walked up to the masters. "I am sorry to have won this contest, as I did the last one with the prison."
"You!"
Ty said, incredulous. Ty had 5 spots on him. Not bad.
"You got hit at least 2 dozen times."
"I believe," Zeth replied, "that the rules stated the winner was the one with the fewest marks on his uniform." He held his hands to the side, showing his white clothing washed clean during his swim. Warren and Key shared a look. She nodded with a hint of a smile.
"There is always one," Warren said, "who notices that. Remember that while loopholes are to be exploited, Zeth San Nutoro, they are dangerous to rely upon. Still, you have done well, both in your performance and in seeing this hole in the rules."
He glanced into the night, squinting at the 2 High Spren who seemed to have made themselves visible to Warren as well.
"Others agree."
"He used a weapon,"
one of the older squires said, pointing.
"He broke the rules."
"I used a pole to block pouches," Zeth said, "but I did not attack anyone with it."
"You attacked me,"
said the woman he'd thrown at someone else.
"Physical contact was not forbidden, and I cannot help if you are unable to control your lashings when I release you."
The masters didn't object. Indeed, Key leaned in to Warren.
"He is beyond the skill of these. I hadn't realized."
Warren looked back to him.
"You shall soon have your spren, gauging by this performance."
"Not soon," Zeth said. "Right now. I shall say the 3rd ideal this night, choosing to follow the law. I..."
"No,"
a voice interrupted. A figure stood up on the low wall surrounding the Order's stone courtyard. Skybreakers gasped, holding up lanterns, illuminating a man with dark Makabaki skin, highlighted by a white crescent birthmark on his right cheek. Unlike the others, he wore a striking uniform of silver and black. Nin, Sun God, Nail, Naku, Nalan. This man had 100 different names and was revered across all Roshar. The Illuminator. The Judge. A founder of humankind, defender against the desolations, a man ascended to divinity. The Herald of Justice had returned.
"Before you swear, Zeth San Nutoro," Nin said, "there are things you need to understand."
He looked across the skybreakers.
"Things you all must understand. Squires, masters,
Gather our gemstone reserves and mobile packs. We will leave most of the squires. They leak stormlight too much, and we have a long way to go. Tonight, just one,
Key asked.
Tonight. It is time for you to learn the two greatest secrets I know.
Shallan's sketchbook. Mandras. They appear to come in a variety of sizes. They move with a sinuous grace, but unlike sky eels, I don't know if the mandras really need to obey any rules of physics. The wings move in a regular rhythm, but they do not appear to be the source of either locomotion or lift. The shape of the head is exactly the same as the Lux Bren that can be found accompanying great shells. I am sure it's no coincidence that they're the same as those that fly beside sky eels. The process by which the sailors steer is incredible to watch. Each mandra is harnessed with a rig of pulleys on each side. To steer in the desired direction, the pulleys ropes are shortened on the corresponding side and then re-tied to the cleats on the ship's railing.
99. Reachers.
Ner-Gaul was known for driving forces into a battle rage, lending them great ferocity. Curiously, he did this to both sides of a conflict, Voidbringer and human. This seems common of the less self-aware Spren.
From Hesse's Mythica, page 121.
When Kaladin awoke on the ship in Shadesmar, the others were already up. He sat, bleary-eyed, on his bunk, listening to beads crash outside the hull. There almost seemed a pattern or rhythm to them? Or was he imagining things? He shook his head, standing and stretching. He had slept fitfully, slumber interrupted by thoughts of his men dying, of Elokar and Moash, of worries for Drahi and Scar. The darkness blanketed his feelings, making him lethargic. He hated that he was the last to rise. That was always a bad sign. He used the facilities, then forced himself to climb up the steps. The vessel had three levels. The bottom was the hold. The next level, the lower deck, was for the cabins where the humans had been given a spot for them all to share. The uppermost deck was open to the sky, and was populated by Spren. Sill said they were light Spren, but the common name was Reachers. They looked like humans with strange bronze skin, metallic, as if they were living statues. Both men and women wore rugged jackets and trousers, actual human clothing, not merely imitations of it like Sill wore. They didn't carry weapons, other than knives, but the ship had wicked harpoons clipped in racks at the sides of the deck. Seeing those made Kaladin infinitely more comfortable. He knew exactly where to go for a weapon. Sill stood near the bow, watching out over the sea of beads again. He almost missed spotting her at first because her dress was red instead of its normal white-blue. Her hair had changed to black and her skin was flesh-colored, tan, like Kaladin's. What on Roshar? He crossed the deck toward her, stumbling as the ship crashed through a swell in the beads. Storms! And Shallan said this was more smooth than some boats she'd been on? Several Reachers passed, calmly managing the large riggings and harnesses that attached to the Spren who pulled the craft.
Ah, human, one of the Reachers said as Kaladin passed. That was the captain, wasn't it? Captain Eco? He resembled a Shin man with large, childlike eyes made of metal. He was shorter than the Alethi, but sturdy. He wore the same tan clothing as the others, sporting a multitude of buttoned pockets.
Come with me, Eco told Kaladin, then crossed the deck without waiting for a response. They didn't speak much, these Reachers.
Kaladin sighed, then followed the captain back to the stairwell. A line of copper plating ran down the inside wall of the stairwell, and Kaladin had seen a similar ornamentation on the deck. He'd assumed it was decorative, but as the captain walked, he rested his fingers on the metal in an odd way. Touching a plate with the tips of his fingers, Kaladin felt a distinct vibration. They passed the quarters of the ordinary Spren sailors. They didn't sleep, but they did seem to enjoy their breaks from work, swinging quietly in hammocks, often reading. It didn't bother him to see male reachers with books, Spren were obviously similar to Ardents, who were outside of common understandings of male and female. At the same time, Spren? Reading? How odd. When they reached the hold, the captain turned on a small oil lamp. So far as Kaladin could tell, he didn't use a flaming brand to create the fire. How did it work? It seemed foolhardy to use fire for light with so much wood and cloth around.
Why not use spheres for light? Kaladin asked him.
We have none, Iko said. Stormlight fades too quickly on this side. That was true. Kaladin's team carried several larger unset gemstones, which would hold stormlight for weeks. But the smaller spheres would run out after a week or so without seeing a storm. They'd been able to trade the chips and marks to the lighthouse keeper in exchange for barter supplies, mostly cloth, to buy passage on this ship.
The lighthouse keeper wanted the stormlight, Kaladin said. He kept it in some kind of globe.
Captain Iko grunted. Foreign technology, he said. Dangerous. Draws the wrong Spren. He shook his head. At Celebrant, the money changers have perfect gemstones that can hold the light indefinitely. Similar.
Perfect gemstones? Like the Stone of 10 Dawns?
I don't know of this thing. Light in a perfect stone doesn't run out, so you can give stormlight to the money changers. They use devices to transfer it from smaller gemstones to their perfect ones. Then they give you credit to spend in the city.
The hold was closely packed with barrels and boxes that were lashed to the walls and floor. Kaladin could barely squeeze through. Iko selected a rope-handled box from a stack, then asked Kaladin to pull it out as Iko resettled the boxes that had been atop it, then relashed them. Kaladin spent the time thinking about perfect gemstones. Did such a thing exist on his side? If there really were flawless stones that could hold stormlight without ever running out, that seemed important to know. It could mean the difference between life and death for Radiance during the Weeping. Once Iko was done resettling the cargo, he gestured for Kaladin to help him pick up the box they'd removed. They maneuvered it out of the hold and up onto the top deck. Here, the captain knelt and opened the box, which revealed a strange device that looked a little like a coat rack, although only about 3 feet tall. Made entirely of steel, it had dozens of small metal prongs extending from it, like the branches of a tree. Only it had a metal basin at the very bottom. Iko fished in a pocket and took out a small box from which he removed a handful of glass beads like those that made up the ocean. He placed one of them into a hole in the center of the device, then waved toward Kaladin.
Stormlight.
For what?
For you to live.
Are you threatening me, Captain?
Iko sighed and regarded him with a suffering expression. Very human in its nature. It seemed the look of a man talking to a child. The Spren captain waved his hand, insistent, so Kaladin took a diamond mark from his pocket. Cradling the sphere in one hand, Iko touched the glass bead he'd put in the fabrial.
"This is a soul," he said. "Soul of water, but very cold."
"Ice?"
"Ice, from a high, high place," he said. "Ice that has never melted. Ice that has never known warmth."
The light in Kaladin's sphere dimmed as Iko concentrated.
"You know how to manifest souls?"
"No,"
Kaladin said.
"Some of your kind do," he said. "It is rare. Rare among us, too. The gardeners among the cultivation Spren are best at it. I am unpracticed."
The ocean bead expanded and grew cloudy, looking like ice. Kaladin got a distinct sense of coldness from it. Iko handed back the diamond mark, now partially drained, then dusted off his hands and stood up, pleased.
"What does it do?" Kaladin asked. Iko nudged the device with his foot. It gets cold now.
Why?
Cold makes water, he said. Water collects in that basin. You drink and don't die.
Cold makes water?
It didn't seem to be making any water that Kaladin could see. Iko hiked off to survey the spren steering the ship, so Kaladin knelt beside the device, trying to understand. Eventually, he spotted drops of water collecting on the branches of the device. They ran down the metal and gathered in the basin.
Huh.
When the captain had said, during their initial negotiations, that he could provide water for human passengers, Kaladin had assumed the ship would have some barrels in the hold. The device took about a half hour to make a small cup of water, which Kaladin drank as a test. The basin had a spigot and a detachable tin cup. The water was cool, but flavorless, unlike rainwater. How did coldness make water, though? Was this melting ice in the physical realm somehow and bringing it here? As he was sipping the water, Syl walked over, her skin, hair, and dress still colored like those of a human. She stopped next to him, placed her hands on her hips, and went into full pout.
What? Kaladin asked. They won't let me ride one of the flying spren.
Smart.
Insufferable.
Why on Roshar would you look at one of those things and think, you know what, I need to get on its back? Syl looked at him as if he were crazy.
Because they can fly.
So can you. Actually, so can I.
You don't fly. You fall the wrong way.
She unfolded her arms so that she could fold them immediately again and huff loudly.
You're telling me you're not even curious what it's like to climb on one of those things?
Horses are bad enough. I'm not about to get onto something that doesn't even have legs.
Where's your sense of adventure?
I dragged it out back and clubbed it senseless for getting me into the army. What have you done to your skin and hair, by the way?
It's a light weaving, she said. I asked Shallan because I didn't want rumors of an honor spren spreading from the ship's crew.
We can't waste Stormlight on something like that, Syl.
We used a mark that was running out anyway, she said. So it was worthless to us. It would have been depleted by the time we arrived. So it's wasting nothing.
What if there's an emergency? She stuck her tongue out at him, then at the sailors at the front of the ship. Kaladin returned the little tin cup to its place on the side of the device, then settled with his back to the ship railing. Shallan sat across the deck near the flying spren, doing sketches.
You should go talk to her,
Syl said, sitting next to him. About wasting Stormlight? Kaladin said. Yes, perhaps I should. She does seem inclined to be frivolous with who she expends it for. Syl rolled her eyes.
What? Don't go lecture her, silly. Chat with her. About life. About fun things.
Syl nudged him with her foot.
I know you want to. I can feel that you do. Be glad I'm the wrong kind of spren, or I would probably be licking your forehead or something to get at your emotions.
The ship surged against a wave of beads, the souls of things in the physical world.
Shallan is betrothed to Adolin, Kaladin said. Which isn't an oath, Syl said. It's a promise to maybe make an oath sometime. It's still not the sort of thing you play around with.
Syl rested her hand on his knee.
Kaladin, I'm your spren. It's my duty to make sure that you're not alone.
Is that so? Who decided?
I did. And don't give me excuses about not being lonely or about only needing your brothers in arms. You can't lie to me. You feel dark, sad. You need something, someone, and she makes you feel better.
Storms. It felt like Syl and his emotions were double-teaming him. One smiled with encouragement while the other whispered terrible things. That he'd always be alone, that Tara had been right to leave him. He filled another cup with as much water as he could get from the basin, then carried it toward Shallan. The pitching of the ship almost made him dump the cup overboard. Shallan glanced up as he eased down beside her, his back resting against the deck's railing. He handed her the cup.
It makes water,
he said, thumbing at the device, by getting cold.
Condensation. How fast does it go? Navani would be interested in that.
She sipped the water, holding it in her gloved, safe hand, which was strange to see on her. Even when they'd traveled the bottoms of the chasms together, she'd worn a very formal hava.
You walk like they do,
she said absently, finishing her sketch of one of the flying beasts. They?
The sailors. You keep your balance well. You'd have been at home as a sailor yourself, I suspect.
Unlike some others. She nodded toward Azure, who stood across the deck holding onto the railing for dear life and occasionally shooting distrusting glares at the Reachers. Either she did not like being on a ship, or she did not trust the Spren. Perhaps both. May I? Kaladin asked, nodding toward Shallan's sketch. She shrugged, so he took the sketchpad and studied her pictures of the flying beasts. As always, they were excellent.
What does the text say? Just some theorizing, she said, flipping back a page in her notebook. I lost my original of this picture, so this is kind of crude. But have you ever seen something like these arrowhead Spren here?
Yeah, Kaladin said, studying her drawing of a sky eel flying with arrowhead Spren moving around it. I've seen them near great shells.
Chasm fiends, sky eels, anything else that should be heavier than it actually is. Sailors call them Lux Spren on our side.
She gestured with the cup toward the front of the ship where sailors managed the flying beasts.
They call these mandras, but the arrowhead shapes on their heads are the same shape as Lux Spren. These are bigger, but I think they, or something like them, help sky eels fly.
Chasm fiends don't fly.
They kind of do, mathematically. Bavamar did the calculations on Reshi great shells and found they should be crushed by their own weight.
Huh, Kaladin said. She started to get excited.
There's more. Those mandras, they vanish sometimes. Their keepers call it dropping. I think they must be getting pulled into the physical realm. It means you can never use only one mandra to pull a ship, no matter how small that ship. And you can't take them, or most other Spren, too far from human population centers on our side. They waste away and die for reasons people here don't understand.
Huh. So what do they eat?
I'm not sure, Shallan said. Syl and Pattern talk about feeding off emotions, but there's something else that...
She trailed off as Kaladin flipped to the next page in her notebook. It seemed like an attempt at drawing Captain Eco, but was incredibly juvenile. Basically just a stick figure. Did Adolin get a hold of your sketchbook? He asked. She snatched the book from him and closed it.
I was just trying out a different style. Thanks for the water.
Yes, I had to walk all the way from over there. At least 7 steps.
Easily 10, Shallan said. And on that precarious deck. Very dangerous. Practically as bad as fighting the fused. Could have stubbed your toe, or gotten a splinter, or pitched over the side and been lost to the depths, buried by 1,000,000 beads in the weight of the souls of an infinite number of forgotten objects.
Or... that?
Highly unlikely, Shallan agreed. They keep this deck well maintained, so there really aren't any splinters.
With my luck, I'd find one anyway.
I had a splinter once, Shallan noted. It eventually got out of hand.
You did not just say that.
Yes, you obviously imagined it. What a sick, sick mind you have, Kaladin.
Kaladin sighed, then nodded to the sailors. They do walk about barefoot. Have you noticed that? Something about the copper lines set into the deck.
The copper vibrates, Shallan said, and they keep touching it. I think they might be using it to communicate somehow.
That would explain why they don't talk much, Kaladin said. I'd have expected them to watch us a little more than they do. They don't seem that curious about us.
Which is odd, considering how interesting Azure is.
Wait, just Azure?
Yes, in that polished breastplate and striking figure, with her talk of chasing bounties and traveling worlds, she's deeply mysterious.
I'm mysterious, Kaladin said. I used to think you were. Then I found out you don't like good puns. It's truly possible to know too much about somebody. He grunted. I'll try to be more mysterious. Take up bounty hunting. His stomach growled. Starting with a bounty on lunch, maybe. They'd been promised 2 meals a day, but considering how long it had taken Iko to remember they needed water, perhaps he should ask. I've been trying to track our speed, Shallan said, flipping through her notebook. She went quickly through the pages, and he could see that, oddly, they alternated between expert renditions and comically bad ones. She landed on a map she'd made of this region in Shadesmar. Alethi rivers were now peninsulas, and the Sea of Spears was an island, with the city named Celebrant on the western side. The river peninsulas meant that in order to get to the city, the ship had to swing to the west. Shallan had marked their path with a line. It's hard to gauge our progress, but I'd guess that we're moving faster than the average ship in our world. We can go directly where we want without worrying about the winds, for one thing. So, 2 more days? Kaladin asked, guessing based on her marks. More or less. Quick progress. He moved his fingers down toward the bottom of her map. Thalen City? He asked, tapping one point she'd marked. Yes. On this side it will be on the edge of a lake of beads. We can guess the Oathgate will reflect there as a platform like the one we left in Kolinar. But how to activate it? I want to try. Dalinar is in danger. We need to get to him, Shallan. In Thalen City. She glanced at Azure, who maintained that was the wrong direction to go. Kaladin, I don't know if we can trust what you saw. It's dangerous to presume you know the future. I didn't see the future, Kaladin said quickly. It wasn't like that. It was like soaring the sky with the Stormfather. I just know... I know I have to get to Dalinar. She still seemed skeptical. Perhaps he'd told them too much of the lighthouse keeper's theatrics. We'll see once we get to Celebrant. Shallan closed her map, then squirmed, glancing back at the railing they'd been leaning against. Do you suppose they have chairs anywhere? These railings aren't very comfortable for sitting against. Probably not. What do you even call these things? Shallan said, tapping the railing. A deck wall? No doubt they've made up some obscure nautical word, Kaladin said. Everything on a ship has odd names. Port and starboard instead of left and right. Galley instead of kitchen. Nuisance instead of Shallan. There was a name. Railing? Deck guard? No, whale. It's called a whale. She grinned. I don't really like how it feels to sit against this whale, but I'm sure I'll eventually get over it. He groaned softly. Really? Vengeance for calling me names. Name. One name. And it was more a declaration of fact than an attack. She punched him lightly in the arm. It's good to see you smiling. That was smiling? It was the Kaladin equivalent. That scowl was almost jovial. She smiled at him. Something felt warm within him at being near her. Something felt right. It wasn't like with Laurel, his boyhood crush, or even like with Tara, his first real romance. It was something different, and he couldn't define it. He only knew he didn't want it to stop. It pushed back the darkness. Down in the chasms, he said, when we were trapped together, you talked about your life. About your father.
I remember, she said softly, in the darkness of the storm. How do you do it, Shallan? How do you keep smiling and laughing? How do you keep from fixating on the terrible things that have happened? I cover them up. I have this uncanny ability to hide away anything I don't want to think about. It's getting harder, but for most things I can just...
She trailed off, staring straight ahead.
There. Gone.
Wow.
I know, she whispered. I'm crazy.
No.
No, Shallan. I wish I could do the same. She looked at him, brow wrinkling. You're crazy.
How nice it would be if I could simply shove it all away.
Storms.
He tried to imagine it, not spending his life worrying about the mistakes he'd made, not hearing the constant whispers that he wasn't good enough, or that he'd failed his men.
This way I'll never face it, Shallan said.
It's better than being unable to function.
That's what I tell myself.
She shook her head.
Yasna said that power is an illusion of perception. Act like you have authority, and you often will. But pretending fragments me. I'm too good at pretending.
Well, whatever you're doing, it's obviously working. If I could smother these emotions, I'd do so eagerly. She nodded, but fell silent, then resisted all further attempts to draw her into conversation. 100. An Old Friend. I am convinced that Ner'Ghaul is still active on Roshar. The accounts of the Alethi thrill of battle align too well with ancient records, including the visions of red mist and dying creatures. From Hesse's Mythica, page 140. Dalinar remembered almost everything now. Though he still hadn't recovered the details of his meeting with the Night Watcher, the rest was as fresh as a new wound, dripping blood down his face. There had been so many more holes in his mind than he'd realized. The Night Watcher had ripped apart his memories like the fabric of an old blanket, then sewn a new quilt out of it. In the intervening years, he'd thought himself mostly whole, but now all those scars had been ripped free and he could see the truth. He tried to put all of that out of his mind as he toured Vedanar, one of the great cities of the world, known for its amazing gardens and lush atmosphere. Unfortunately, the city had been devastated by the Vedan Civil War, then the subsequent arrival of the Everstorm. Even along the sanitized path he walked for the tour, they passed scorched buildings, piles of rubble. He couldn't help but think of what he'd done to Rathalas, and so Evie's tears accompanied him. The cries of dying children. Hypocrite, they said. Murderer. Destroyer. The air smelled of salt and was filled with the sounds of waves smashing on cliffs outside the city. How did they live with that constant roaring? Did they never know peace? Dalinar tried to listen politely as Taravangian's people led him into a garden full of low walls overgrown with vines and shrubs, one of few that hadn't been destroyed in the Civil War. The Vedans loved ostentatious greenery, not a subtle people, all brimming with passion and vice. The wife of one of the new Vedan high princes eventually led Navani off to inspect some paintings. Dalinar was instead led to a small garden square, where some Vedan light eyes were chatting and drinking wine. A low wall on the eastern side here allowed for the growth of all kinds of rare plants in a jumble, which was the current horticultural fashion. Lifespren bobbed among them. More small talk?
Excuse me, Dalinar said, nodding toward a raised gazebo. I'm going to take a moment to survey the city.
One of the light eyes raised his hand.
I can show...
No, thank you,
Dalinar said, then started up the steps to the gazebo. Perhaps that had been too abrupt. Well, at least it fit his reputation. His guards had the sense to remain below at the foot of the steps. He reached the top, trying to relax. The gazebo gave him a nice view of the cliffs and the sea beyond. Unfortunately, it let him see the rest of the city. And storms. It was not in good shape. The walls were broken in places, the palace nothing more than rubble. Huge swaths of the city had burned, including many of the plate-like terraces that had been Vedan showpieces. Out beyond, on the fields north of the city, black scars on the rock still showed where heaps of bodies had been burned following the war. He tried to turn away from all that and look out at the peaceful ocean, but he could smell smoke. That wasn't good. In the years following Evie's death, smoke had often sent him descending into one of his worst days.
Storms, I'm stronger than this.
He could
fight it. He wasn't the man he'd been all those years ago. He forced his attention toward the stated purpose of visiting the city, surveying the Vaden martial capabilities. Many of the living Vaden troops were barracked in storm bunkers right inside the city walls. From reports he'd heard earlier, the Civil War had brought incredible losses, even baffling ones. Many armies would break after suffering 10% casualties, but here, reportedly, the Vadens had continued fighting after losing more than half their numbers. Perhaps they'd been driven mad by the persistent crashing of those waves. And what else did he hear? More phantom weeping. Tone's palms. Dalinar drew a deep breath, but smelled only smoke. Why must I have these memories? He thought, angry. Why did they suddenly return? Mixing with those emotions was a growing fear for Adolin and Elikar. Why hadn't they sent word? If they'd escaped, wouldn't they have flown to safety? Or at the very least, found a span reed? It seemed ridiculous to assume multiple Radiants and Shardbearers were trapped in the city, unable to flee. But the alternative was to worry that they hadn't survived, that he'd sent them to die. Dalinar tried to stand, straight-backed and at attention beneath the weight of it all. Unfortunately, he knew too well that if you locked your knees and stood too straight, you risked fainting. Why was it that trying to stand tall should make you so much more likely to fall? His guards at the base of the stone hill parted to let Taravangian, in his characteristic orange robes, shuffle through. The old man carried an enormous diamond-shaped kite shield, large enough to cover his entire left side. He climbed up to the gazebo, then sat down on one of the benches, panting.
"Did you want to see one of these, Dalinar?"
he asked after a moment, holding out the shield. Glad for the distraction, Dalinar took the shield, hefting it.
"Ashard,"
he said, noting a steel box with a gemstone inside fastened to the inner surface.
"Indeed,"
Taravangian said.
"Crude devices. There are legends of metal that can block a shard blade, a metal that falls from the sky. Silver, but somehow lighter. I should like to see that, but for now we can use these."
Dalinar grunted.
"You know how they make fabrials, don't you?"
Taravangian asked.
"Enslaved Spren?"
"Spren can't be enslaved any more than a chul can," the Stormfather rumbled distantly in his mind.
"That gemstone,"
Taravangian said,
"imprisons the kind of Spren that gives things substance, a kind that holds the world together. We have entrapped in that shield something that, at another time, might have blessed a night radiant."
Storms. He couldn't deal with a philosophical problem like this today. He tried to change the topic.
"You seem to be feeling better." "It's a good day for me. I feel better than I have recently, but that can be dangerous. I'm prone to thinking about mistakes I've made."
Taravangian smiled in his kindly way.
"I try to tell myself that, at the very least, I made the best choice I could with the information I had."
"Unfortunately, I'm certain I didn't make the best choices I could," Dalinar said.
"But you wouldn't change them. If you did, you'd be a different person."
"I did change them," Dalinar thought. "I erased them. And I did become a different person." Dalinar set the shield beside the old man.
"Tell me, Dalinar,"
Taravangian said.
"You've spoken of your disregard for your ancestor, the Sunmaker. You called him a tyrant."
"Like me."
"Let us say," Taravangian continued, "you could snap your fingers and change history. Would you make it so that the Sunmaker lived longer and accomplished his desire, uniting all of Roshar under a single banner?"
"Turn him into more of a despot?" Dalinar said.
"That would have meant him slaughtering his way all across Aesir and into Eri."
"Of course I wouldn't wish that."
"But what if it left you, today, in command of a completely unified people?" What if his slaughter let you save Roshar from the Voidbringer invasion? He'd be asking me to consign millions of innocents to the pyre.
Those people are long dead,
Taravangian whispered.
What are they to you? Numbers in a scribe's footnote? Yes, the Sunmaker was a monster. However, the current trade routes between Herdaz, Yarkaved, and Aesir were forged by his tyranny. He brought culture and science back to Alethkar. Your modern Alethi cultural eruption can be traced directly back to what he did. Morality and law are built upon the bodies of the slain.
I can't do anything about that.
No, no. Of course you can't.
Terebengian tapped the half-shard shield.
Do you know how we capture Spren for Fabrials, Dalinar? From Spanreeds to Heatreels, it's all the same. You lure the Spren with something it loves. You give it something familiar to draw it in, something it knows deeply. In that moment, it becomes your slave.
I really can't think about this right now. Excuse me, Dalinar said. I need to go check on Navani.
He strode from the gazebo and down the steps, bustling past Ryle and his other guards. They followed, towed in his wake like leaves after a strong gust of wind. He entered the city, but didn't go looking for Navani. Perhaps he could visit the troops. He walked back along the street, trying to ignore the destruction. Even without it, though, the city felt off to him. The architecture was very like Alethi architecture, nothing like the flowery designs of Carbranth or Thelenha. But many buildings had plants draping and dangling from every window. It was strange to walk along streets full of people who looked Alethi but spoke a foreign tongue. Eventually, Dalinar reached the large storm shelters right inside the city walls. Soldiers had set up tent cities next to them, temporary bivouacs they could tear down and carry into one of the loaf-like bunkers for storms. Dalinar found himself growing calmer as he walked among them. This was familiar. This was the peace of soldiers at work. The officers here welcomed him, and generals took him on tours of the bunkers. They were impressed by his ability to speak their language, something he'd gained early in his visit to the city, using his bondsmith abilities. All Dalinar did was nod and ask the occasional question, but somehow he felt like he was accomplishing something. At the end, he entered a breezy tent near the city gates where he met with a group of wounded soldiers. Each had survived when his entire platoon had fallen. Heroes, but not the conventional type. It took being a soldier to understand the heroism of simply being willing to continue after all your friends had died. The last in line was an elderly veteran who wore a clean uniform and a patch for a defunct platoon. His right arm was missing, his jacket sleeve tied off, and a younger soldier led him up to Dalinar.
"Look, Gevid, the Blackthorn himself. Didn't you always say you wanted to meet him?"
The older man had one of those stares that made him seem like he could see right through you.
"Bright Lord," he said, and saluted. "I fought your army at Slickrock, sir. Bright Lord Nalinar's 2nd Infantry. Storming fine battle that was, sir."
"Storming fine indeed," Dalinar said, saluting him back. "I figured your forces had us at 3 different points."
"Those were good times, Bright Lord. Good times. Before everything went wrong."
His eyes glazed over.
"What was it like?" Dalinar asked softly. "The Civil War, the battle here at Vadenar." "It was a nightmare, sir."
"Gevid," the younger man said, "let's go. They have food."
"Didn't you hear him?"
Gevid said, pulling his remaining arm out of the boy's grip.
"He asked. Everyone dances around me, ignoring it. Storms, sir. The Civil War was a nightmare."
"Fighting other Vaden families,"
Dalinar said, nodding.
"It wasn't that," Gevid said. "Storms, we squabble as much as you do, sir. Pardon that. But I ain't ever felt bad fighting my own. It's what the Almighty wants, right?"
But that battle, he shuddered. Nobody would stop, Brightlord. Even when it should have been done. They just kept right on fighting. Killing because they felt like killing.
It burned in us, another wounded man said from by the food table. The man wore an eye patch and looked like he hadn't shaved since the battle.
You know it, Brightlord, don't you? That river inside of you, pulling your blood all up into your head and making you love each swing, making it so that you can't stop, no matter how tired you are.
The thrill. It started to glow inside Dalinar. So familiar, so warm, and so terrible. Dalinar felt it stir like a favorite axe hound, surprised to hear its master's voice after so long. He hadn't felt it in what seemed like an eternity. Even back on the Shattered Plains, when he'd last felt it, it had seemed to be weakening. Suddenly that made sense. It wasn't that he'd been learning to overcome the thrill. Instead, it had left him. To come here.
Did others of you feel this? Dalinar asked.
We all did,
another of the men said, and Gevid nodded.
The officers, they rode about with teeth clenched and rictus grins. Men shouted to keep the fight, maintain the momentum.
It's all about momentum. Others agreed, talking about the remarkable haze that had covered the day. Losing any sense of peace he'd gained from the inspections, Dalinar excused himself. His guards raced to keep up as he fled, moving even faster as a newly arrived messenger called to him, saying he was needed back at the gardens. He wasn't ready. He didn't want to face Taravangian or Navani or especially Renarin. Instead, he climbed the city wall. Inspect the fortifications. That was why he'd come. From the top, he could again see those large sections of the city, burned and broken in the war. The thrill called to him. Distant and thin. No.
No.
Dalinar marched along the wall, passing soldiers. To his right, waves crashed against the rocks. Shadows moved in the shallows, beasts two or three times as big as a chull, their shells peeking from the depths between waves. It seemed that Dalinar had been four people in his life. The bloodlusty warrior, who killed wherever he was pointed, and the consequences could go to damnation. The general, who had feigned distinguished civility when secretly he'd longed to get back on the battlefield so he could shed more blood. Third, the broken man, the one who paid for the actions of the youth. Then finally, the fourth man, most false of them all, the man who had given up his memories so he could pretend to be something better. Dalinar stopped, resting one hand on the stones. His guards assembled behind him. A Vaden soldier approached from the other direction along the wall, calling out in anger.
Who are you? What are you doing up here?
Dalinar squeezed his eyes shut.
You, Alethi, answer me! Who let you scale this fortification?
The thrill stirred, and the animal inside him wanted to lash out. A fight. He needed a fight. No. He fled again, hurrying down a tight, constricting stone stairwell. His breathing echoed against the walls, and he nearly stumbled and tripped down the last flight. He burst out onto the street, sweating, surprising a group of women carrying water. His guards piled out after him.
Sir? Ryle asked. Sir, are you... Is everything...
Dalinar sucked in stormlight, hoping it would drive away the thrill. It didn't. It seemed to complement the sensation, driving him to act.
Sir?
Ryle said, holding out a canteen that smelled of something strong.
I know you said I shouldn't carry this, but I did. And you might need it.
Dalinar stared at that canteen. A pungent scent rose to envelop him. If he drank that, he could forget the whispers, forget the burned city and what he'd done to Rathalos. And to Evie. So easy.
Blood of my fathers, please. No.
He spun away from Ryle. He needed rest. That was all, just rest. He tried to keep his head up and slow his pace as he marched back toward the Oathgate.
the thrill nipped at him from behind. If you become that first man again, it will stop hurting. In your youth, you did what needed to be done. You were stronger then.
He growled, spinning and flinging his cloak to the side, looking for the voice that had spoken those words. His guards shied back, gripping their spears tightly. The beleaguered inhabitants of Vaidnar scurried away from him.
Is this leadership? To cry each night, to shake and tremble? Those are the actions of a child, not a man.
Leave me alone!
Give me your pain.
Dalinar looked toward the sky and let out a raw bellow. He charged through the streets, no longer caring what people thought when they saw him. He needed to be away from this city. There, the steps up to the Oath Gate. The people of this city had once made a garden out of its platform, but that had been cleared away. Ignoring the long ramp, Dalinar took the steps two at a time, Stormlight lending him endurance. At the top, he found a cluster of guards in Colin blue standing with Navani and a smattering of scribes. She immediately strode over.
Dalinar? I tried to ward him off, but he was insistent. I don't know what he wants.
He?
Dalinar asked, puffing from his near run. Navani gestured toward the scribes. For the first time, Dalinar noticed that several among them wore the short beards of Ardents. But those blue robes? What were those?
Curates, he thought. From the Holy Enclave in Valeth.
Technically, Dalinar himself was a head of the Boren religion, but in practice the curates guided church doctrine. The staves they bore were wound with gemstones, more ornate than he'd expected. Hadn't most of that pomp been done away with at the fall of the hierocracy?
Dalinar Colin,
one said, stepping forward. He was young for an Ardentia leader, perhaps in his early 40s. His square beard was streaked with a few lines of gray.
I am he,
Dalinar said, shrugging off Navani's touch to his shoulder.
If you would speak with me, let us retire to a place more private.
Dalinar Colin,
the Arden said louder.
The Council of Curates declares you a heretic. We cannot tolerate your insistence that the Almighty is not God. You are hereby proclaimed excommunicate and anathema.
You have no right.
We have every right. The Ardents must watch the light eyes so that you steer your subjects well. That is